Hello and welcome to another episode of The Foxhole Companion with me, Dan Stewart.
And me, Simon Rance.
So today we've got a double feature for you.
We have.
Having watched Reach for the Sky, we decided it was so boring that there's no way we could fill an hour talking about it because there's nothing to talk about, really.
No.
So we decided to take a look at another film we were going to do called Hurricane, about the Polish 303 Squadron, known for some reason in the States as Mission of Honor.
Yeah, terrible title.
With no U. Come on, spell it right. Come on, America, sort it out. Anyway, so that's, well, aren't you lucky? Two for the price of one.
Well, I don't know how lucky anyone is having to listen to two middle-aged men talk about Reach for the Sky, but still. What a strange, disappointing film that was.
Well,
I mean, it's only 2 hours, 15 minutes long, but it felt like six.
Oh, after 10 minutes, we were like, is it nearly over?
I was gutted. I was so excited. Because it's one of those movies I'm sure I've seen before, but I haven't. Clearly, I haven't. I've seen bits of it, I think.
See, I remember watching it as a kid, and I don't know what I was watching, because I sort of thought it was a great war film, but maybe I only saw the last 15 minutes of it.
It's a real bummer, because I was excited about having a top-heavy episode on Kenneth Moore.
Yeah, I mean, we love Kenneth Moore.
Yeah.
I mean, what a disappointment. And he's perfectly fine in this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's just a nothing film, isn't it?
Oh. Well, I'm gonna cut straight to...
I bet loads of people love it.
Well, they're not going to love this podcast,
no,
then.
No, they're not.
So to explain and to cut to the chase, we'll do Dan's pocket history.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, last episode we talked a lot about the Battle of Britain, so we don't really need to recap the blow-by-blow account of it. Douglas Bader, not Bader, as he's very keen to point out in the film.
Yeah.
Bader! God damn you! And he's that sort of a fella. He does a lot of shouting. Listen, the research I've done, and... Okay, I'll start with this. In Britain, when I was a kid, he was a bit of a legend. He was a war hero, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and all the more so because he had no legs. Now, I had always assumed he had no legs because he lost them in some heroic battle over the fields of Britain, taking on the Huns single-handedly, but he didn't. He lost his legs by being a twat.
By showing off.
And that was basically the story of Douglas Bader. Is he's not a nice man, Simon.
No, I've heard that. I've heard it insinuated that he wasn't a very nice chap. It does feel weird having to smear his name, though.
Don't worry, I don't feel weird about
okay,
that.
Okay, that's fine, as long as you do it. You do it on our behalf.
So, to get on with the smearing... Jesus. Well, so as the film sets out in early doors, Douglas Bader was a sort of prototypical posh public schoolboy. He was properly good at rugger and cricket.
Yeah, so good at rugby, wasn't he going to play for England? So...
No, well, it wasn't England. He apparently he was supposed to have played for the Harlequins once. Americans, Harlequins were a very famous professional rugby team.
Not then, though. They were amateur, obviously.
Well, everyone was amateur.
That's
back
what
then.
I mean. Yeah.
He was also, as the film makes out, jolly good at cricket, because there's a mad scene where he's smacking them all over the field. And one fella watching goes, how much has Bader got? And he goes, he's got 101. And then they just all walk off the field.
Yeah.
Clapping him on the back, both sides being like, good show, old man.
Yeah, it's very odd.
I mean, obviously they just decided it was no point playing on because Bader was just going to score thousands of runs.
Yeah.
Anyway, the character that Kenneth Moore plays, in the words of Douglas Bader, he said, everybody, I'm paraphrasing, but he basically said, everybody thinks I'm that dashing figure that Kenneth Moore portrays, and I'm not. So even he was pretty honest about the fact that he wasn't very nice.
But that's weird, because Kenneth Moore's not particularly nice.
No, he does it.
He must be really horrible.
Can you imagine? Because Kenneth Moore doesn't... I mean, he must have met him in the making of this.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And maybe Kenneth Moore was like, I can't play that. I'll never work again. So he's obviously tried to make him as charming as possible. But here's the thing about real-life Douglas Bader as opposed to Kenneth Moore Douglas Bader is that he was extremely big-headed. He thought he was the absolute best at everything. It seems like he has friends in all sorts of high places that any time he got in trouble, he got bailed out. He kept getting arrested while he was a cadet... in the RAF for speeding around on his motorbike, which the movie does show, and that not content with getting a ticking off by the policeman who lets him go, while he's getting a ticking off, his mates go and take the wheels off the copper's bicycle.
Oh, that's one of my...
And he cycles into a hedge.
Yeah, one of my favourite notes of the film is...
Yeah, go on.
Bastard toffs, copper over the handlebars, into the privet hedge.
Yeah. So, as we discover in the film, Douglas Bader lost his legs by basically showing off in his plane.
Yeah.
And everything I read is he wasn't that good a pilot. He just had such aggression. He was such an aggressive individual that his sort of bullheaded do-or-die attitude, you know, made him a bit of a legend. But,
you can tell... And Moore portrays that in a way that it's just this ultra, ultra competitive streak.
Yeah.
Where he just will not be beaten.
Yeah. So in the film, what you get is that his recuperation from having his legs amputated is totally down to the fact that medicine couldn't save him. It was his own ferocious willpower. That he overhears a nurse saying, shh, there's a boy dying in there.
Right, yeah.
And he goes, bloody well not dying, you know. And he doesn't die. But yeah, so he loses his legs by being an idiot. And here's something interesting. He carried on being an idiot. So the RAF wouldn't let him fly again because they're like, you got no legs, mate. Which is fair enough, because anyone knows anything about flying. It's not just waving your joystick around. Wait! It's...
Dear me.
You've got to use your legs for the pedals.
Yep.
So, if you got no legs, that's a problem. Anyway, when war breaks out, he does manage to get his job back in the RAF. When he's training, he crashes again in a Spitfire, writes off a Spitfire because he had forgotten to switch the propeller from the propeller pitch from coarse to fine, and so it ran out of control down the runway and crashed, and he survived. He busted his head up, but he was all right. He got out probably going, well, that's a bloody rubbish, only to find his metal legs that he'd received were completely bent, and as he pointed out, he realised that if he'd not lost his legs previously, he would definitely have lost them this time.
Oh, my God.
I mean, imagine being enough of a numbskull in a plane that you would have actually have lost your legs two times over. I mean, I know it was a dangerous, hazardous thing to do back in those days, but still, twice.
Yeah, that is a bit mental.
Anyway, he gets his own troop, and then this is... They're not a troop, are they? Because they're airmen. He gets his own squadron of flyers, and as the movie points out, they're really disillusioned, upset Canadians who've lost all their mates. They don't even have uniforms because they had to basically run away from France as quick as they could.
That's the 240 squadron, 240 squadron.
Yeah.
And which is, a lot of the time, was based out of one of the most beautiful places on planet Earth.
Oh, God, here we go.
Coltishall in North Norfolk.
I have actually filmed at what was RAF Coltishall.
Lucky and... man.
The only thing...
It's amazing.
The taxi driver, you know, he didn't want to tell me about, oh, RAF Coltishall, the home of Douglas Bader and the furious 240 squadron. No. His thing that he couldn't wait to tell me about is he goes, look at that prison, it's full of pedos.
It is known locally as having what's called the Beast Wing, which is, you can imagine, is
prisoners who wouldn't be anywhere else.
So a good friend of mine works there actually at the prison. But God. I know Coleshill. I knew the air base very, very well. It was an RAF base, up until I think probably 15, 20 years ago. And excuse me, my primary school, we would swim there. It was our closest swimming pool. So we would swim there.
What,
every
in the
Friday.
Prison?
No, it was a RAF base.
All right.
When it was still a RAF base. It's the quintessential back in the day RAF base. You know, when I was visiting it once a week, it was still, you know, very, very much looked like you could be in World War II. It's full of kind of like dilapidated prefabs. And, you know, like everything looks like a mess hall. But it was a fascinating place because I find those, you know, those kind of bases are fascinating. And Norfolk's full of them. It's got a lot of RAF bases and also US bases. And they are like towns within a town. They're a completely separate community. Very creepy as well. It is like going back in time.
Well,
but there was a Spitfire there and a Lightning. And
they're out front, aren't they?
Yes. And,
yeah.
are they still there?
They're still there.
Weird. What, to advertise the prison? How strange.
Well,
this
maybe
is a paedophile prison. Look at our Spitfire.
Maybe it's to advertise the film studios. Anyway, back to Douglas Bader. So, yes, so the his squadron at RAF Coltishaw, which is in Norfolk.
Yay!
God,
one of the best
us.
Lines, actually, if we just keep talking about Norfolk for a little bit longer.
Oh, please do. I know you have to.
It's when he's talking to his squadron and, like, I think, like, for a bit of R&R, it's just like, let's go into Norwich shopping. I'm like, well, absolutely. There you go.
Is that it?
That is it, yeah. And also,
So what you're boasting about here is that Norwich actually has shops.
I'm boasting that it's mentioned. Norwich has been mentioned, and I lived there for a good many years. But he's, and around that time as well, he's talking to a squadron leader Edwards,
yep.
who isn't, but looks just like a Eraserhead.
He's got mad hair, isn't he?
Yeah.
Anyway, Bader and his Canadians get sent down to Duxford to form the Duxford Wing. So they were basically moved south to help with the masses of German fighters and bombers that were piling over 6-7 times a day. Now, here's the bit of controversy. I mean, the bit of controversy, I say that. When you examine Douglas Bader, almost every aspect of him is controversial. Bader was best friends with Air Vice Marshal Trafford Lee Mallory, and the two of them came up with this tactic.
That's a great name.
I know, it does not get more English than that, does it? So they came up with this tactic that I mentioned on last week's podcast, the big wing tactic,
yeah.
which was basically you'd send up 90 fighters and you would just have at it. I mean, this big wing tactic sums up who Douglas Bader was. Send up tons of men and shoot at everything and, yeah, it'll be over by Christmas.
Well, that's right, the Duxford Wing's 5 squadrons, right?
Right. The problem was they couldn't get up in the air and form quickly enough to take on incoming bandits. They couldn't get the altitude that Bader insisted they have, and it just took... It takes a long time for 90 planes to get in the air and all sort of get together and get to the right height, which is not the way that the Battle of Britain was fought. So Air Marshal Hugh Dowding, who we love mostly just because he was played by the brilliant Laurence Olivier, his tactics were basically to send small squadrons up, 6-9 planes, and pick off whoever they could find or intercept planes that were coming in and run away again. And it was brilliant, and it worked. But Bader, he seems to me, Simon, like if he had been a general in the First World War, he would say, send 100,000 men at once.
Oh, no, basically he's...
It'll be over by Christmas.
His his philosophy seems that of Stalin.
Yeah, just send them all in.
Throw everything at them.
Yeah.
Put them in a meat grinder, basically.
Now, because of his influence and that of Air Vice Marshal Trafford Lee Mallory, they basically tried it out, and it's mixed as to the success of it. What everyone did agree on is it took them too long to get airborne and to where they had to be. And often when they got there, the Germans had left and gone on and bombed somewhere.
That's not ideal.
Not ideal. They didn't really clock up any greater amount of kills than the regular way of doing it. But what it did end up doing is getting poor old Air Vice Marshal Parks, Vice Air Marshal Parks, fired from his job.
Oh, Keith.
Yeah. And not long after that, Laurence Olivier was gone as well.
Dowding was gone as well.
Yeah, they got rid of them both. And it wasn't really a great idea. I've got an interesting quote here from one of Baader's own squadron. RAF ace Johnny Johnson. There's another name for you. God, if you're going to be a Battle of Britain hero, you've got to be called Lieutenant Johnny Johnson.
Oh, was he his best mate who visited him in hospital in the film?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, that's...
He seemed like quite a nice man, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
So he said, Douglas was all for the big wings to counter the German formations. I think there was room for both tactics. I think he's being generous. The big wings and the small squadrons. It might well have been fatal had Park always tried to get his squadrons into Balbos, which are, for some reason, that's what they called these big wings. For not only would they have taken longer to get to their height, but 60 or 70 packed climbing fighters could have been seen for miles and would have been sitting ducks for higher 109s. That's the Messerschmitt German 109s. Also, nothing would have pleased Goring more than for his 109s to pounce on large numbers of RAF fighters. Indeed, Adolf Galland and Werner Molders, who were German aces, complained about the elusiveness of fighter command and that Park's brilliance was that by refusing to concentrate his force, he preserved it throughout the battle.
Right. Makes total sense.
This does not mean, as Baader pointed out at the time, that two or three Balbos from 10 and 12 groups gaining height beyond the range of the 109s would not have played a terrific part in the fighting.
Right. Very diplomatic.
Very diplomatic.
He sounds like a politician.
Yeah. Now, talking of politicians, and this is the last bit I'm going to say about the great British war hero, Douglas Baader, is that in... Some of you aren't in Britain will have maybe followed what's been going on in this country in the last 4 years, but there's basically several people in high positions of power who thought that it would be a really good idea to leave Europe because of the bloody foreigners coming over here and stealing our jobs. I got to tell you, were Douglas Baader around today, he would make Nigel Farage look quite moderate. And I'm going to...
Where are you getting this, you know, which source material have you dug that up from?
So, I'll tell you.
Did he go into politics?
God, I don't like this man. A staunch conservative.
Oh, boo. Oh, hold on. You can't say that. Look, some people might actually vote conservative.
Yeah, no, you can't say. Yeah, it's all very well. I mean, Winston Churchill was a conservative.
Yeah.
And a staunch one at that.
Not half.
A staunch conservative, his trenchantly expressed views on such subjects as juvenile delinquency, capital punishment, apartheid and Rhodesia's defiance of the Commonwealth.
God!
By the way, he was a strong supporter of Ian Smith's white minority regime.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are you joking?
Oh, wait. I haven't even got started yet. This is so bad. But this is facts, people. We need to know the facts about our so-called heroes. If there's a statue of him, it's not going to be around much longer, I can tell you that. When quite a few African countries joined the Commonwealth and then were critical of the decision to intervene in the crisis in Egypt, the Suez crisis, Douglas Baader was quoted...
Oh no, go on.
They bloody well should climb back up their trees.
Whoa.
What a lovely fella.
Jesus.
He then expressed in a TV interview that became extraordinarily controversial that he would quite like to be Prime Minister and listed. He listed some of the things that he would get on with as soon as he was in charge, includes...
The Douglas Baader political manifesto for the far-right party.
Jesus. I mean,
go on,
anyway.
What was it?
Thank God he was fighting on our side.
Yeah, that's true.
He could have won the war for the Nazis. So some of the things he fancied getting on with as Prime Minister were to withdraw sanctions from Rhodesia. But if people remember the politics of the 60s, Rhodesia was basically governed by a white minority government who treated the native Africans appallingly, and quite rightly the world put sanctions on them. No, not for Douglas. He wanted them gone. Right. He wanted to stop immigration into Britain immediately until, quote, the situation had been examined. He wanted to reintroduce the death penalty for murder, and he wanted to ban betting shops because he said the streets of Britain were becoming like Chicago in the 1920s. He hated trade unions.
That doesn't surprise
And he
me.
Described people in the CND movement, which included me, as a rabble who should be deported. Douglas Bader, ladies and gents, the hero of the Battle of Britain. And this is why I'm loath to really discuss this film, because,
well,
Kenneth Moore tries his best, but go on.
Okay.
I'm furious now.
Okay.
I'm furious.
Reach for the Sky, not a socialist manifesto by any means, was made in 1956, okay? And it was directed and screenplay written by the one and only Lewis Gilbert.
Whee!
Probably best known for Alfie.
Whee!
And three Bond movies.
Three
yep.
Bond movies. That's the second director in a row.
Yeah, Guy Hamilton, who did Battle of Britain, was also a Bond director. But Lewis Gilbert directed one of my faves. Well, two of my faves. Well, one's a fave, one's an extreme guilty pleasure.
Go on.
So one of my faves is You Only Live Twice.
Great film.
Yeah, that's a cracker. You got Donald Pleasance as a bloke.
Oh, best.
So, yeah, Gilbert directed that. And he directed The Spy Who Loved Me, which is a kind of all right. But he directed Moonraker, which I love. I love Moonraker. It's awesome.
You know
I won't have a word against it.
Guilty pleasure. That's like...
I won't have a word against Coltishall or Moonraker, okay? It was based on the book by Paul Brickhill. As we said, obviously starring Kenneth Moore. Muriel Pavlov.
By the way, I just interject... What Bricknell, was it?
Brickhill.
Brickhill. Brickhill, when describing Douglas Bader, who he was obviously using for research in his book, described him as a very difficult person.
Yeah. Again, diplomacy. Ahoy. Yeah, so just quickly back to Lewis Gilbert.
Go on.
He died at the ripe age of 97.
Get in.
In Monaco.
Lived right? longer than Bader.
Yeah, so apart from those Bond movies and Reach for the Sky, he also worked with Kenneth Moore again 4 years later on Sink the Bismarck, which we will be covering.
Oh, can't wait for that.
Well, if it's anything like this, I can wait. He also made Educating Rita,
which is a fab film.
Yeah, and Shirley Valentine.
So he worked with Michael Caine quite a bit then.
Yeah, it's a rich and varied career, you'd have to say.
Yeah.
I don't know what he was up to when he made this, but...
varied?
He was having an off day, I reckon.
So
if I just go through a few of my notes on
go
the
on
film...
Go on,
And we'll try to, you know, make
it sound as fun as possible.
Yeah, so I've got around the sort of accident bit, the show off, the crash, and then Bader, Moore as Bader says, I can't feel my legs. And it's just like, it's because you ain't got any. And then they are so damaged he can't feel them. And then his mum visits him in hospital, which is a moment when you think this should be quite moving, you know, because she, you know, basically the doctor's saying, like, come on, mum, give us permission to saw his bleeding leg off.
Yeah.
And she whimpers a little. And then it's just like, but there's nothing there, right? There's
nothing.
There's no tension in this film, which is insane.
I know, it's the Battle of Bloody Britain.
It's the Battle of Britain, and it's about one man's battle for survival against all the odds.
I mean, if you were to just put in perspective, films about disability, because, yes, we're going to get loads of tweets from people pointing out Douglas Bader's work for disabled charities, and I'm sure that was great. But if you're going to put a film, which is what we're here to talk about disability, if you put My Left Foot and the struggle that that film examines to have any kind of a life, this basically makes it, oh, his legs come off and then he's playing golf.
I know. So we've got...
no struggle.
No, there's no struggle. There's no tension. And so it's very hard to have any sort of empathy for him because, as you said, he comes across as a bit of a git.
Yeah.
And the fact that that is so diluted to the real Bader is a bit of a worry.
Yeah, I know. That's the that was as nice as they could make him without reinventing the man.
That's the problem. It does, though, like all movies of the era. Well, first of all, let's just say it's made in 1956, but it feels like it was made in the early 40s. Yeah, it feels so old-fashioned and so out of... so old-fashioned even for the, you know, mid to late 50s.
Battle of the River Plate, also a film from the 50s, feels 10 times more modern than this.
No, it really does. And it feels cheap.
Yeah.
Which is weird.
Cheap.
Because clearly, you know, Moore's a known... I mean, this was probably a huge breakthrough for him, but he's already a known actor.
Here's how cheap it looks, right? I've been saying to Simon throughout the film as we were watching it, I'm like, look at the state of these Spitfires. They look terrible. They're all rusty. And what I think we've seen here is they had one Spitfire. I don't know why they could only come up with one when Battle of Britain came up with dozens that actually flew, and so many that they could actually crash them, that they had one that they must have found in a barn somewhere, and it was all rusty. And all the others, I kept going, what's wrong with these planes? And we finally worked out that they must have been made out of balsa wood and painted really badly to look like Spitfires. Those are the ones on the ground.
Much like Lovejoy's Spitfire model.
Lovejoy's Spitfire looks like a work of art compared to the... What was the art department thinking?
Rubbish.
Oh, it's awful. Cheap, tacky-looking rubbish.
But again, from, as I was about to say, sorry, before I went on about how old-fashioned and old it feels, is that for a movie made in that era, it does have some choice lines, like off-the-cuff lines, generally by someone who only has one line in the film, throwaway line.
They've got some good...
So there's a... He's driving along and, like, all over the place, and truck driver complains, goes, what's your name, mate? Death?
I know.
It's like, who wrote that? That's a terrible line. It also doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't. It's the sort of thing that I would do when I get in a fight with a motorist. And then you're on the way home. You're like, oh, why did I say that?
I wish I'd said this.
Yeah. another favourite line of mine, Simon, while we're doing favourite lines, is the taxi driver comes to pick him up at the hospital, or whatever he was. He was like a private in a car come to pick up the great Douglas Bader, right?
Yeah.
And a nurse goes, oh, well, he's not here right now. He's gone for a walk. Everyone's frightfully, frightfully like this. And he goes, for a walk? Cool blimey.
Yeah, for a walk, eh? Cool blimey. And then that's when he's leaving the hospital and he's got his legs, isn't it?
Oh, and then it's really...
And he just kisses everybody.
This is what makes your skin crawl. Let's not tar the real Douglas Bader with what Kenneth Moore came up with. But Kenneth Moore was very handsy, is what you'd say, to be polite.
He's very much of its time.
He's literally semi-conscious, having had both his legs amputated, and a nurse leans over and he tries to snog her.
Yeah, he's going for it.
And then when he leaves, all the nurses have to line up and get a kiss from him. It's the sort of thing that if you heard that Jimmy Savile had done it, you'd be like, well, that sounds about right for Jimmy Savile. What are they thinking?
I know. But again, that is of its time, isn't it? That very, but it's full
being a rapey bastard.
It's a very, very strange. I mean, but how I'd sum the film up in one, right, is it's a strange celebration of bloody mindedness.
Yeah.
And although it's all very quaint and British, and although Kenneth Moore is always watchable. But he's hardly Mitchum, right, when you're talking about someone being... Or Montgomery Clift, when you're talking about someone being totally in charge of their craft.
Right? Yeah.
But not once did I... not once did I come out of it thinking, I'm watching a bloke pretending not to have any legs. I believed that, you know, I believed that totally. Even though when Kenneth Moore was strutting about, he did look like he was in Thunderbirds. Do you know what I mean?
He did, Simon did say this.
Captain Scarlet, maybe.
Well, what they must have done is strapped his legs up so he couldn't bend them at the knee. Obviously, they didn't take off Kenneth Moore's legs and give him prosthetics for the purpose.
That's taking method far too far,
yeah,
darling.
Yeah, yeah. That's what Dan Day-Lewis would have done. No, he. They obviously made his legs sort of so that he couldn't put them side by side and couldn't bend them. So it does give him this very odd walk, which I seem to remember as a kid watching, you know, Douglas Bader on TV, is he had, you know, very robotic-like walk because of, you know, prosthetics were not particularly advanced back then.
Yeah.
I've got as a note here, Simon, just to sort of put this movie in context, I don't know what minute this was in, but it was probably a good hour and 20 minutes into the film. War breaks out, finally.
Well, regarding that kind of vibe, I've got in my notes, I went to the toilet, I said, please don't pause it. Which never happens.
No.
And I come back and I go, what did I miss? And he says, Dan said, nothing. And then and I was like, what? And he says, like, oh, all right, they got married and he's learned to play golf.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like what that film is, you know. And then my favourite line I've written so far is that, and the Battle of Britain was over, but unfortunately, this film is not.
Jesus,
but there are a couple of things which we had a giggle about, and apart from the what's your name, mate, Dev, is when he goes to Duxford to start up the Duxford thing with the five squadrons.
Yep.
The first thing that happens is that like a petty officer comes in, right,
yep,
with a huge stack of files, and he goes like, "These are files for your attention, sir." And he and Bader just goes, "Yeah, whatever," and he throws the whole lot in the bin.
I know. I mean, there were probably top secret, super important memos that could have turned the tide of the war. He just chucked them in the bin.
So he gets nicked, right? And he gets caught in France, right?
Yeah.
And manages to escape out the window, giving it the full sort of Rumpelstiltskin.
That's
with
right.
Yeah, putting all the bed sheets.
We forgot
together.
To mention this in the life story of Douglas Bader is generally being as crap as he was at everything. He actually got himself shot down. Desperately, this is how bad he was, right? He was so desperate to have the highest number of kills in the Battle of Britain and in the RAF that he forced his poor squadron into the air time after time after time, and they were all exhausted.
That's like Catch 22.
I know, and even Lee Mallory was like, you know, maybe we want to give him a rest, and he went, no. And so Mallory went along with it. And so he ends up going.
So did he manage to kill half his squadron then, essentially?
Well, I don't know.
By proxy.
He gets shot down and instantly captured by the Germans. Talking of Germans, my favourite thing is when he escapes from the hospital after they've very kindly given him his uniform and a new leg back. The Germans are lovely in this. He escapes because he's got to meet a man with a cigarette in a doorway, which is suddenly we're all very film noir, aren't we? And as they're approaching the house that he's going to be stowed away in, the Germans arrive, and the guy playing the Frenchman who's helping him escape goes, Les Boches!
Les Boches! Oh, that's brilliant. Les Boches!
Now, I don't...
What's quite funny about that is, it's just like, right, the person, he's told, isn't he? He's like... the person that's going to help you escape will be smoking a cigarette outside a cafe. Yeah. And it's just like, what, like everyone else in France? That's ridiculous. Every Frenchman in a black and white movie is smoking a cigarette.
Yeah, that's what we said. We were like, well, that will narrow it down for a minute.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. But we are saved in the film because Anton Driffin shows up.
Now... Those of you who are scratching your head going, I don't remember that name, tell them, Simon.
Well, he's one of the Nazi officers in the Schloss Adler in Where Eagles Dare.
Oh!
And then, so after that, once he's caught again by Driffin, He's sent to Colditz, isn't he?
Yeah.
Where he stays until 1945.
And the Germans are really nice about it. They're like, look, we can't really keep... You keep running away, mate, and you're shit at it because you got no legs. So could you just go to Colditz, please? He's like, I'm not bloody leaving. And they're like, oh, look, if we have to take you out, people are going to get hurt. And his mate, who he's now shacked up with in this camp, this prison camp, goes, oh, be a good fellow, you know. Bullets tend to fly and it's pretty densely packed in here. And so he goes out and the Germans all line up for him, like give him a guard of honour. I tell you what, the Germans were nicer to Baader than Baader was to his own airmen.
Yeah, and you've also got in that sort of, that part of it, so he's doing a sort of comedy trope of like inspecting the German soldiers, isn't he, on his way out.
Yeah.
You know, and he's always taking the pee. He's always taking the pee. And he's very, he's kind of like, I can't say punk rock, because you say punk rockers, you're talking about anti-establishment. He's very anti-authority, though.
Yeah.
He's very anti-authoritarian.
Yeah, he hates any sort of authority, doesn't he? Just to quickly go back to...
But yet he's always shouting at his lot.
Like, I know.
So he's like very authoritarian with his squadron. He's just not a nice bloke.
Yeah.
It's that simple.
Here's some, just to go back to Anton Driffin, because he's great. And oh, when you watch things like this, you really just, I cannot wait for Where Eagles Dare. But not only Where Eagles Dare, the Blue Max, he played a lot of Germans, but he looks so German, doesn't he?
Is he not German?
Isn't he?
Is Anton Driffin not German? Is he Austrian?
Hang on, let me look at his full bio. It says, what was ironic about his typecasting as a Nazi is that Driffing, born in Koblenz, Germany, fled Nazi Germany in 1939. So, yes, he was German. You're absolutely right.
Right.
But, not only was he in Where Eagles Dare and the Blue Max, he was in Escape to Victory.
Ah!
One of my all-time favourites. Come on. What a legend. Anyway, have we talked enough about this stupid film?
Yeah, so also for...
Hate it.
I have a very, very special edition of this film. It's in top nick. It's a quality product. It's not blue. It's not Blu-ray, unfortunately. It's a freebie giveaway from the Daily Telegraph about 20 years ago. And it's up for grabs, people.
Is it?
Yeah, it's up for grabs. So we will send it.
I sort of feel like we can't send that to anyone.
No, I don't want it in my house. It's going.
Let's just burn it.
No, we can't.
Nobody's going to want to win that.
Yes, they
First
will.
First of all, it on my super DVD system, I think you've got to have the very first DVD player ever made and an old tube television for this to look remotely good, because it looks terrible. We can't prize that off.
All right.
Sorry, I wouldn't do that to you, Foxhole
fans.
That
was a bit of a psych. People were there, they were rubbing their hands with glee.
If anyone really fancies winning this, or even just not even winning it, just wanting it, drop us a line on Twitter. It's free on Amazon. Why would you want that tatty old...
Because it's a piece of history, dear. We need to ask a question, though. If you can answer this question correctly. Okay, so here's a question for World War II movie lovers, right?
Go on.
Which two films were directed by Brian G. Hutton?
All right, there we go.
Now let's put this one to bed talk of this crime against culture again. Out of five, Dan...
One.
Oh, really?
I'm being generous, mate.
Well, I gave Confessions of a Nazi Spy half.
Yeah. Was it better than that?
Yes, it was. So I'm giving this a two.
What?
Yeah, it's a two out of five. That's not a great rating, mate. But it's not the worst thing I've ever seen either. It's boring and it's dull.
All right.
Okay.
Stereotypical Nazi.
Anton Driffin.
Thank you. He's going to win it every time.
Yeah.
Stereotypical Brit.
I liked the squadron leader Edwards, who looked like a razor head.
Yeah. Yeah.
All of them are stereotypical Brits. All of them.
I think it's... I'm going to give the Stereotypical Brit Award to the two fellas who basically goad Bada into showing off in his plane, which then ends up with him crashing and losing his legs.
Fair enough.
That's so awful.
Yeah. Is there a Best Death Award?
That's the weird thing, is it doesn't really show anyone dying.
Well, a few planes get shot down, don't they? As to be expected in the Battle of Britain. Okay, let's
move on
quickly. Please move on. Now, let's talk about 2018's Hurricane.
Known in the States as...
Mission of Honor?
Yeah.
Mission of Honor.
What a terrible title.
That is a terrible title. This is directed by David Blair. And it stars, is it Ewan? Ewan Rian?
I don't know how to pronounce that because it's Welsh.
Yeah, anyway, he plays the lead. He plays the Polish lead.
Ewan Rian. Maybe you say it in a Welsh accent. Ewan Rian.
That didn't sound well.
Didn't it? All right.
Also, it stars Mel Gibson's son, Milo Gibson. And I've got a fun fact for you about
this.
Go
on.
Now, see, unlike Dan, who's actually worked with very famous actors, I just generally walk past them. Now, I walked past him
Did you?
In a bar in Malibu. How about that? And he was there. There you go.
Wow.
And my friend said, that's Mel Gibson's son. And he was surrounded by a gaggle of young ladies.
I bet. He's not bad looking. He's the spitting image of his old man.
It also stars one of the best names ever.
Go on.
Stephanie Martini.
Yeah.
She's not very good in it, though. It also stars Robert Portal. He plays Keith Park. And then it's got a bloke who I always get muddled up as Jeffrey Palmer, as Hugh Dowding. Who is it? Nicholas Farrell.
Yeah, Nicholas Farrell. From
Chariots of Fire.
You'll have seen him in Chariots of Fire, amongst many, many other things. He also played Horatio in Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet. Terrific actor.
Right.
Okay. And he's very good in this as well.
Okay. And it's also starring an actor who's quite big in Poland, probably not very well known here.
Go on.
His name's Matt Malecki, and he is a mate of my wife's. And they've worked together in the theatre.
Yeah.
He's a terrific actor. So he plays Ziggy Klein in this.
It is odd. Simon and I talked about this. That they cut... Because there's a lot of Polish in this. The Polish airmen speak Polish to each other with subtitles, as they should in a film. You never want that thing where it's like two lines of Polish and then suddenly everyone speaks English, which I hate that convention.
Yeah.
They keep speaking Polish all the way through. Why did they cut? I mean, I know that Ewan Rian is very famous from Game of Thrones and whatnot.
And he's very, very good.
He's great. And great, I think he does charisma. A very good Polish accent. And he speaks Polish, so fair play to him. But why didn't they cast a Polish actor? I was just saying to Simon before we recorded, I think the lead from Katyn would have been great in this.
Well, either of the leads from Katyn.
Yeah.
They're both terrific. but he is very, very good. This film was also released at the same time as another film about the famous 303 Squadron.
Yeah.
Which I believe is just called 303 Squadron, which is a fully Polish production.
Right.
So they get muddled up, you know, from time to time.
Yeah.
Now, this is a film which really sort of requires, because there is so many aerial battle sequences, it really requires a massive budget, and it doesn't have one. It hasn't got a small budget. I suppose in today's term, it is pretty small. It's a 10 mil budget, right? It needs a 60 mil budget.
Yeah.
And the only time you're taken out of the zone is when it comes to the special effects. They do all look like they've been banged up on a laptop.
See, I wasn't bothered by them.
Really?
Yeah, I thought...
Including the air raid stuff, the searchlights across London, the dogfight.
I've got to be honest, the CGI... It's obviously CGI, ladies and gents. The CGI dogfights and the planes in the air look 10 times better than the crappy balsa wood models jiggling around on strings in Reach for the Sky.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
Oh!
So this...
Terrible film!
So this film, you can see on Netflix in the UK. I'm not sure about the States.
Amazon, wasn't it? Didn't we watch it on Amazon?
No, it's on... Hurricane's on Netflix.
All right.
It's, yeah, the story of the 303 Squadron, which we talked about a lot in the Battle of Britain episode. Yeah. The 303 Squadron flew out of, was it Northolt?
Yes.
And they are, there is a monument to them in the outskirts of West London, right? The Polish War Memorial.
Yeah, and Simon and I are going to go do a visit. It's opposite what I think is RAF Hendon. I may be wrong about that.
No, RAF Hendon's north.
That's on the M1, isn't it? Yeah. Not the M40. Yeah. Yeah. It's opposite an airport. It's opposite an airport of some kind.
Yeah.
Which I think might have been Northolt.
Right, okay. That would make complete sense.
That's where the memorial right, is.
It's like Sherlock Holmes and Watson in here, I tell you.
Bloody hell.
Yeah, so, yeah, tell us about the 303 Squadron then.
Well, we did talk a little bit about them last episode. Previous to Britain properly getting involved in the war, although they had declared war on Germany when Germany invaded Poland, the Polish Air Force didn't have great kit. They were flying these weird little old World War I biplanes, but nevertheless made a very good account of themselves. And as much as they could, escaped from the clutches of the Nazis and the Russians in Poland and found their way to Britain. Well, to France, actually, where they were sort of thrown into a ragtag collection of fighter pilots. And it wasn't until, well, really, the Battle of Britain broke out that they were recognised at all as being a unit that could even fly planes.
And then, obviously, what happened after that, they get the highest amount of kills.
Well, this is it.
In the RAF at that point.
So the poor old Poles were basically looked at and treated as second-class citizens by the RAF. With the likes of Douglas Bader running around.
I'm not surprised.
Wanting all the foreigners deported.
Yeah.
It's not really a surprise. I mean, if that was his general attitude, you've got to imagine that was sort of reflected in the higher command of fighter command. But anyway, here were this group of extremely experienced, very talented pilots, as some historians have pointed out, more experienced than the kids who were getting 6 hours flying time and then strapped in a plane only to get shot down immediately. they were given a commanding officer, a squadron leader, who was Canadian. So they didn't even bother giving them an English leader. They were like, oh, give that Canadian fella to them, he'll be fine. So squadron leader Kent headed them up.
Which is the character played by Milo Gibson.
That's correct. And he basically pulls this, and as the film portrays them, listen, this is a very, very, very pro-Polish, very anti-British film, which I'm fine with, because after researching Douglas Bader, I basically, the stereotypes that they portray the British as, I'm totally in line with.
I'm pro
anything Polish.
Anything Polish to do with World War II, because they were just under such appalling constraints as a nation, as a people, and they showed total heroism.
Yeah. So they were formed up into 303 Squadron, but they were basically there as a last resort, and it was 2 months into the Battle of Britain before they were deployed as an active unit. And instantly, they just were tearing up the skies of Britain. They shot down, the 303 Squadron claimed more kills than any other squadron during the Battle of Britain. The Czech air ace, Josef František, who died, unfortunately, when his plane crashed on the 8th of October before the end of the Battle of Britain, was the highest scoring pilot of the 303 Squadron and the highest scoring ace in the Battle of Britain. Now, to put this in perspective, right, the Poles didn't join the Battle of Britain until 2 months into the Battle of Britain.
Wow.
Right? So they were way behind all the other Commonwealth fighter pilots.
Okay.
And yet they still managed to clock up more kills than anyone else during the Battle of Britain. And a pilot who started 2 months late and was killed before the end of the Battle of Britain had the highest number of kills as a solo pilot.
So that's Josef Franciszek.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now he's played by Christoph Haddock, who's great in this. And
fabulous.
Has a wonderful like line when you see Matt Malecki and Ewan Rheon at the bus, remember?
Yeah.
And he just basically slags off the British, he slags off the Poles.
He hates everybody.
He's shouting at everyone. And he says, oh, by the way, I speak Polish, so don't call me an arsehole, you dickhead, or something. It's like, wow, he's angry. But he's very, very funny. It's a really good performance by him. So he was the highest ace, was he?
In 303 and in the entire fighter command the Battle of Britain.
Amazing. Why isn't there a bloody statue of him in Parliament Square?
Well, I'll give you one reason. Douglas Bader. Racist bastard. So these fellas basically were just, I mean, and they do express this in the film. Nicholas Ferrell's character, who's playing, is he playing Lee Mallory or
he's playing Dowding.
He's playing Hugh Dowding, who is reluctant at first. In fact, one of his lines was, just post them anywhere, just not anywhere near the fight. He doesn't want them involved. And the brilliant Robert Portal, who plays Air Vice Marshal Keith Park, he's the one that's like, oh, go on, give them a go.
Yeah.
You know, they've got a lot of experience. Just the figures on the first day they were active. They shot down something like 15 planes on the first day they were active.
Wow.
And they carried on like that. I mean, I'm not going to waste time just reading through the victories they had on day to day to day, because any history book you will grab hold of will do it in that kind of detail much better than I can. But it is astonishing when you do look at it. They just, every time they went up, they were just taking down dozens and dozens of German planes with very, very few losses on their side as the battle intensified. And certainly on the 15th of September, they started having their losses as well. But it's hard to sort of express what an enormous part they played in winning the Battle of Britain. Air Chief Marshal Sir Hugh Dowding said after the Battle of Britain, and I think he might have actually been quoted this after the Second World War had finished, had it not been for the magnificent material contributed by the Polish squadrons and their unsurpassed gallantry, I hesitate to say that the outcome of the Battle of Britain would have been the same.
Amazing.
So this little squadron of Polish pilots played such a pivotal role in the Battle of Britain, and they're not recognised half as much as they should be.
No, they're not. Well, and also, this is just one of the Polish squadrons, right?
Yeah, there were three.
Right. So, you know, and the 303 squadron is most famous because obviously it's got the most kills. But and why that isn't burnt into the folklore of this country is anyone's guess. But I think recent political persuasions and things called Brexit tell you why.
Mm.
It's just, it's so sad that we can't even find it within ourselves to like celebrate these people.
Who saved our asses.
Many of them died and risked their lives for us. And yeah. it's an outrage, really.
And
what do they get? It's a pretty impressive war memorial, I've got to say, but it is a hill.
They're weird. There's a couple of them, aren't there?
Yeah.
Simon and I will go visit and we'll take some pictures of ourselves. Here's the worst part of it. They sort of look like...
look like large green cinnamon buns.
Yeah, but they also look a bit
pretty.
Like, as somebody from, you know, with ties to the north... They look like when slag heaps have been deliberately grassed over to try and improve the landscape.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that's what I've always thought. I never even knew it was a monument.
Oh, really?
No. I just thought it was like it was just some weird sort of hill formation.
No, that's what it is.
Anyway, let's also highlight that the Czech pilot Josef František scored more kills than Douglas Bader.
Ah.
And flew 2 months less.
Are you joking?
Yeah, I rest my case. Because he died on October 8th.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, it's tragic, the end of that, because that's when they're just coming back, isn't it?
Yeah.
In the movie. So the film... So back to the film itself.
Go on.
There is a wonderful sequence where the 303 Squadron are basically given a huge sort of Dorchester Hotel party celebration
to
banquet.
Recognise their
And it's quite touching because it's at that point where Ewan Rheon has sort of come to the conclusion that his wife is quite possibly dead. He's sort of woken up to the fact he knows it now. And it's really tragic. They've also just lost a couple of pilots, one of them being Ziggy Klein, who was a Jewish pilot, played by Matt Malecki. And by the way, Ewan Rheon's character, Jan Zumbach, was also had Swiss blood.
Yeah,
as well.
So he was a quarter pop. Swiss.
Yeah. So that sequence where they're sort of being celebrated, they all have a few glasses of champers, and anyway, he previously Ewan Rheon's character Jan Zumbach had to parachute out, and he got stuck on a street light in what looks like cool blimey East London.
It definitely is cool and, blimey East London.
He's taken in by an elderly couple. Their son is in the Navy, I believe.
Yeah, they show him a picture, don't they?
And they make him what looks like the worst sandwich you could ever eat, which only the Brits can make.
Oh, I thought it looked delicious.
Oh, see, that's what I'm saying. It's appalling.
That's my working class roots coming out. Sandwich looks ace.
It's a massive slab of white bread with basically a bit of lettuce and I think probably some very mild cheddar cheese. So
delicious.
The face of Ewan Rheon when he's eating this sandwich is hysterical because he's smiling and it's just like, this is very kind of him, because they say, it's all right, son, we've already had ours. And you know full well they're giving him their rations, right?
Yeah.
And he's like, well, I better eat it, although it tastes like shit. And that's so very kind. Anyway, back at the Dorchester, he's like, you know, people are... Your city is being bombed and you're having a party, he says to Dowding. And he rather drunkenly goes up to the banquet table, gets a load of grub, sticks it on a big plate, walks out with it, and gets Stephanie Martini to drive him to the old couple's house so they can have a big slap-up meal on him. And he gets there, guess what? Every good deed...
House is bombed.
Yeah, which is so they're dead. The house is bombed. It's an inferno, and he drops the food. So actually, nobody gets the food. So I don't know what the moral of that tale is, but I think it is probably don't help old people. I don't know, because it's like, what's that about? But it reminds me very much of the Lovejoy balsa wood burnout. When he takes the model to his kids.
Yeah, so I could see that. Yeah, and then he comes back and the shelter's been bombed.
The ending of the film is very poignant.
Very.
So the war is over. And basically, you know, Stephanie Martini's character, Phyllis, is like saying to Jan Zumbach, it's like, well, this is good, isn't it? You can go home now. Yeah. And it's just like, to the Soviet Union's invasion, because they now have our country. And I mean, imagine the despair of fighting against the Nazi horde for another country, essentially. And then
being forced
in
to
victory,
repatriate.
And it's just like, nah, thanks for your help, off your pop.
So as highlighted in the film, they had a choice to, I can't remember the way that it's described, but they had to apply for a sort of third class citizen passport to stay. And it shows a little montage of the Polish fighter pilots that have done it. One of them's driving a taxi, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And the other choice was to be repatriated to Poland, which, of course, nobody wanted, because why would you want to live under Stalin? And, of course, as they point out in the film, a lot of the soldiers that did go back to Poland ended up being tortured and murdered and executed by Stalin because they had been westernized. I've got several favorite bits in this film. The squadron's got quite famous because of their huge number of kills. So the Air Vice Marshal Park persuades Dowding to send the press over because it'd be great for morale and whatnot. So the press arrive, and it's at a high point for the Polish squadron. They're all feeling like they're invincible, and they're enjoying the hell out of murdering Germans, as they would. And the press show up, and there's one fella, right? He's a bit like this, and he's a reporter. He hides behind, right, when the others are forced to leave. And he pops out as the squadron land and come back down, having just suffered their first losses. And he's like, "You, oh, not so smiley now, are we, lads?" At which point he gets punched in the face.
He gets massively dead.
But my best bit of that is it cuts to Air Marshal Dowding in his office saying, "Oh, I hear there's a bit of a to-do." And Park basically says, "Yeah, well, a reporter stayed behind." And he goes, "What paper did you write for?" And he says, "The Daily Mail." And the face, the face that Nicholas Ferrell pulls is classic, because it's like he'd just somebody put dog poo under his nose. And he's like, "Oh, that filth." Now, to put into context for those of you who aren't familiar with the Daily Mail, it is an extreme right-wing piece of tat newspaper who, by the way, at the beginning of the war, supported Oswald Mosley's black shirts. They supported the Nazis.
I bet they still do.
Of course they still do.
Anyway, let's not get sued.
Anyway, another great bit is the Czech pilot who went on to be the ace of Battle of Britain. He's a little careless, and he's a little sort of, you know, and there's a big thing at the beginning where they're getting trained and they just want to get in planes and shoot things.
Mm-hmm.
And Milo Gibson basically says, "Look, fellas, I appreciate you want to get up and at them, but there are basics you need to know. Like, you've got to put the wheels down when you land." And they all go, "Listen, we'll learn about fuel gauges. We'll learn about ammunition. We'll learn about, you know, vectors, but don't tell us how to fly." And then it cuts to the Czech fella's coming down and he's forgotten to put his wheels down. And he grounds out and he gets out of the plane. And Milo Gibson goes, "You didn't put your bloody wheels down." And he goes, "Oh, wheels up, wheels down, who cares?" It's brilliant. Now, the British in this film are not portrayed well. With the exception of Dowding, who sort of comes around, and Air Vice Marshal Park, who's treated quite well. There's a rival squadron, because it's the only part of this that I don't really enjoy, is you've got to have the girls in it for the bit of the love interest, right? Now, I don't know whether what love interest there was between Polish airmen and the WAFs at their base or anything like that, but the Poles are in the pub having a pint, and in come these three English, very, very English fighter pilots who are
top heavy on silk cravats.
Yeah, a lot of silk cravats. And they're miffed because when they come in, they're told to shush by the girls because a Polish fighter pilot's playing something beautiful on the piano. And so they're like, "Oh." And then one of the Poles gets on and plays something jolly.
And that's right, they call them savages.
Yeah, they call bloody savages. And one of them, of course, is dancing with the ringleader's girl. So
Rollo's girl.
Rollo's girl. So he gets in a huff and pushes the Polish guy. And, of course, the Czech comes flying in and nuts him.
Is it the Czech? I thought it was the angry Polish dude.
Oh, was it? It is the angry Polish dude.
And for the, you know, I cannot find for the life of me who that actor is. I go on the IMDb, there's no picture of him.
Really?
And he is terrific.
He's great.
And he's so fiery and feisty. Yeah. It's just like, he is exactly who you want on your squadron.
I love the fact that every time they show a British person, with the exception of the old couple who take in our hero when he's stuck on a lamppost outside their house, the British...
He's one of us!
He's one of us! Give him a sarnie. Where our heroine works, pushing those little flags around the map, she gets into trouble because for some... And I don't buy... I'm sorry, but this just doesn't ring true. But they're plotting things and there's a patrol of Germans coming in and she says to her squadron leader, I think that's a feint. It's going to be a bigger... They're kind of trying to distract us away from a bigger flight of German planes that are coming somewhere else. And he dresses her down, her squad... And she's put in her place very firmly by a really unpleasant fella.
Yeah, and strangled.
Well, that's later on. She's not having it, so she takes her headphones off and shouts, Vice Marshal, I insist you pay attention to me. So he comes down and it cuts to they're all looking, and sure enough, the big flight of German planes does appear elsewhere. It was a feint, and he congratulates her. Meanwhile, as she's knocking off for the night on a staircase, this squadron leader catches up with her and goes, if you ever, ever humiliate me like that again. And he strangles her.
Yeah, it's dark.
And then keeps sexually harassing her for the rest of the film.
Yeah.
It's like...
The Brits don't come across well. For example...
I think people were too busy doing
Daily Mail journalist.
But that's great.
You know, Daily Mail journalist. All the wing commanders, apart from...
Milo Gibson.
Yeah. Well, he's not British, is he?
No, that's what I'm saying.
Oh, no. But all the wing commanders come across as toffs.
Yeah.
Basically, we're a bunch of toffs. That's what this film says.
A bunch of jingoistic toffs.
And if it wasn't for a check and a mass load of Poles, we'd be screwed.
Yeah,
and
we'd all be speaking German now.
And one of the great lines in it is basically, you English need all the help you can get.
Oh, I love that.
And it's
that.
Like, yeah, you're right.
The nasty English fighter pilot squares up with our hero, Ewan Rion, and says, he goes, what the bloody hell do you know about flying? You're a bunch of, what does he call them, savages.
Yeah.
And he says to him, in his best Polish drawl, he says, I have fought in my country with people hanging from lampposts and trees. And he goes, you should be afraid, very afraid.
Yeah, no, it's
great.
There are some really, really great parts to it. And we definitely recommend that you watch this film. What would you give it out of 5, Dan?
I'm going to go with 4.
Okay.
What about you?
3.5.
Oh, blimey, it's your Polish people.
Yeah, but it could be so much better. One of the other criticisms of the film is that I think it has a very weak soundtrack. It doesn't have any stirring music.
Yeah, you like that, don't you?
Trying to use stirring music, but the music isn't stirring.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense.
And so it falls at that hurdle, and some of the, what I'd have to say, cool subplots feel like they're getting in the way. So the whole Rollo bit for me, you could cut that whole section out.
I know, I know there has to be obstacles and controversy and challenges for our heroes to deal with, but I honestly, from all the interviews and all the books I've read, it seems to me that the fighter pilots during the Battle of Britain were far too exhausted and far too scared and far too overwhelmed to be picking fights with Polish fighter pilots. It just doesn't read true. It really doesn't. And I'm afraid the bit with the WAFs didn't really read true either.
Fair enough. I mean, it's a good film with some very good bits and some weak spots, you know.
Yeah, you know what? No, I'm going to stay with 4. I'm going to stay with 4. Okay. I just want to read out, because at the end of the film, they do, you know, this just before the credits, little sort of screen titles at the end of the film, which say that 303 were the highest scoring fighter squadron in the Battle of Britain. 145 pilots shot down 203 German planes. And it constituted the Polish squadrons constituted 20% of RAF strength, and they did more than 20% of the work, that's for sure. And then the final title, well, listen, I don't think it's any coincidence that they chose the nasty reporter to be Daily Mail, because their last title card before the titles says, post-war opinion poll showed that 56% of British public thought the Poles should be repatriated. So, I mean, that sort of tells you everything you need to know, really, doesn't it? Go home.
That's so sad.
No thanks.
It's just disappointing.
They didn't even get their own victory parade.
I know. It's very disappointing.
And yet also sort of quite predictable.
Yeah. Well, okay, so back to the film.
Stereotypical Nazi. They do quite a good job of showing the German side of it, don't they? And there's the guy.
Well, the German airfields.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're all... There's one German fighter pilot, very similar to ones we've seen before, who are like, they're looking up at the planes heading to England and basically says something about, you know, here comes a Bosch.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is great.
It's all the hubris of the Nazis in the Battle of Britain. That is there to be seen.
That's for sure. Stereotypical Englishman has got to be Rollo, right?
Rollo?
Yeah, the British fighter pilot.
Yeah. Yeah, stereotypical because he's just a bit of a knob.
He's just such a knob.
He is a
And he's
real
got a
knob.
Knobby face.
Yeah.
And as I said,
he's got a face you really want to punch, don't he?
Well, and it got punched. And as I said to Simon before we started recording, there's a bit where his ex-girlfriend, because now she's shacked up with the Poles, goes to see him because he's been shot down and his face is all burnt off, and you sort of go, yeah, deserved it, really.
Jesus.
Well, come on.
Oh, dear. Okay, so best deaf award.
I think it's got to be our Czech fighter ace. They've chased a Messerschmitt 109 over the channel and into France, and they're not sure they got enough fuel for it, but they take down the 109 and head back. And as the white cliffs of Dover appear, Joseph Frentisek's engine starts stuttering. And there's a great shot as the planes fly over the white cliffs of Dover, except his just flies into the white cliffs of Dover and explodes.
That's sad.
That's pretty good. Yours, best F?
Well, there's two for me. One is when Ziggy Klein gets shot down. So that's Matt Malecki.
Yeah.
Because that's like the first of them to like... you know, get hit.
Yeah.
Or the first one you really feel like that's part of the crew.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But the most spectacular death.
Go on.
Is the German who's parachuting.
Oh.
And the religious pilot who's been firing off
He doesn't
magazines.
He can't kill anyone.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to kill anyone.
But he kills this geezer.
Yeah, but he buzzes past his parachute,
but also,
so all the air goes out of it.
Also, he sort of kills him by proxy, doesn't he?
Yeah, because
he gets killed.
Yeah,
but that this poor chap plummeting to his death in a billowing parachute.
Yeah, that's pretty horrible.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
That's the best death award for me.
All right, so ladies and gents, there you have two films of. Covering the same subject with vastly different outcomes, because if you even make it to the Battle of Britain and reach for the sky, I will be amazed because it's so boring. God. 303 Squadron, fab.
Hurricane, you mean? See, you're going to get confused with the other one too.
The other one. There is another film about the exact same subject called 303 Squadron.
Which came out the same year.
And we don't think is as good, so we didn't cover it.
No. So, what have we got lined up next? Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
Oh, no.
Ladies and gents, Foxhole fans, I've been waiting for this for 2 years. The first movie we watched... No, it was the second movie, because that's why I can't remember it, because we'd had that many beers.
Unfortunately, I can remember it. But hey, I still think it's better than Reach for the Sky.
Oh, it's so much better. We're bringing you next week, as we shift our focus from the skies over the channel...
Into the channel.
into the Channel and the North Atlantic to look at the convoys that were basically breathing life into a completely destroyed Britain, who were not ready for war by any means, and the Americans were sending everything they could over in these convoys across the North Atlantic, which were easy targets for the German submarine crews. So we're going to do a jolly little film. Oh, my God, I can't wait. Called Convoy.
Yep.
It's going to be hilarious.
Yeah, who knows? I might... because of this little project of ours, I have now sat through so many poor movies as well as great ones that maybe because I've seen so many terrible films that watching Convoy this time round, I go like, oh, actually...
It's not bad.
It's a masterpiece compared to some of the crap I've had to watch.
What I sort of remember through my beer-soaked brain...
You don't remember Convoy, come on.
No, I remember there was a white submarine, which was really hilarious.
Oh, God, I don't remember that.
Oh, my Lord.
Like a ghost submarine.
The inside of it was huge and sparkling white.
Oh, yes, yes, no, I do remember that.
Yeah, this is going to be hilarious. Okay. You're going to want to tune in next episode, Foxhole fans... For Convoy.
Amazing.
In the meantime,
you've been listening to
The Foxhole Companion.